Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Bald Move Prestige podcast recording. Today, we're going to be talking about the 1986 Martin Scorsese movie, The Color of Money. This is a sequel to the much earlier work, I think it was 59, The Hustler, that we did a, I think we did this like about this time last year when we were doing kind of like a pandemic movie coverage. So it's been less than a year since I've seen it. As I said, it's directed by Martin Scorsese. It's got a screenplay by Richard Price, who you might recognize as the writer of Mad Dog and Glory, or some of your favorite television shows, such as The Wire, The Night Of, and The Deuce for HBO. It's based on the novel The Color of Money by Walter Tevis, who also wrote The Hustler. And also, if you were not asleep during 2020, wrote the book The Queen's Gambit that was adapted to a Netflix series. It stars Paul Newman reprising his role as Fast Eddie Felsen. It adds to the cast Tom Cruise. You guys know Tom Cruise, right? A famous Scientologist. Amazing face and body at 79 years old, however old he is. Also, Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio, I think is how you pronounce her name, who also starred opposite Ed Harris in The Abyss, Kevin Costner in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. Helen Shaver, who you've certainly seen in TV shows and movies over the years, but she's also been a prolific director as late, directing episodes of Vikings and Westworld. John Turturro from The Big Lebowski, Barton Fink, most recently The Plot Against America on HBO. Bill Cobbs as Orvis, who is a character actor, is featured in The Bodyguard, Hudsucker Proxy, Demolition Man. Forrest Whitaker as Amos. We've seen him recently in Star Wars Rogue One, Arrival, Last King of Scotland. We just did badass series with him in the Bloodsport movie. And then finally, Keith McCready, who is a no shit professional pool player and shark.
Yes. I feel like I recognize this guy from the World Series of Pool or whatever the hell it was that they were.
I did some reading on him, and he was one of the ones that kind of like rode the wave from like when pool was just a hustler sport to, because ironically, this movie kind of there was no kind of Atlantic City nine ball classic open. There is now because of this movie. So like,
and this everybody movie, plays nine ball because of this movie, like all of the pool that's played for money and sport now, I think, is nine ball.
Yeah, these movies keep trying to bring straight pool back and weird variations, but that's nine. That's the fat, hard breaking, fast playing nine ball.
The bangers love the nine ball. The
bangers love the nine ball. Is this movie a banger, Jim? I know we both really like The Hustler. I've never seen this movie before. Have you seen it? And what did you think?
Yes, I have seen this movie before. I think I suggested it because, you know, we watched The Hustler pretty recently and you liked that. And I figure, yeah, you'll probably like this. I had forgotten it was directed by Martin Scorsese, which I think is pretty much on display here. I think there's some good directing here, some interesting shots of pool being played and some kind of inventive stuff a la, you know, Raging Bull and what he does with boxing there.
Some interesting montages.
And I guess I was welcome. I was very open to the idea of more Fast Eddie Felsen after seeing The Hustler. And I remember really liking this movie first time I watched it. This time was no different. This is still a great movie. It's probably an easier watch than The Hustler, I would say. But I don't know that I'd recommend. If I thought someone was willing to watch The Hustler, I don't know that I would recommend watching this first because, you know, even though it's more mainstream, it's more watchable, in my opinion. I just don't. I think there's a lot from The Hustler that you kind of need to know about Eddie to really inform what's going on here. So I don't know. As a companion piece, I think it's great. It's maybe not quite as good as The Hustler, but it's still pretty damn good.
Yeah, I mean, I was wondering that myself because, you know, I just seen the original about a year ago. So I was kind of the ideal audience case for this. It hadn't been 25 years since I've watched the movie. It'd just been a year. And I kept on thinking, like, I wonder how well this would hold up as a standalone. I think it would hold up really well because, you know, the movie alludes to what happened to Paul Newman's character, the Fast Eddie.
Sure.
But it doesn't really dwell on it. And I think that if you didn't want it, like the steep, I guess, ask of The Hustler is that it's just an old film. It's just in its editing, in its filmmaking. I think it still stands out in some of its themes and some of its shot, and just Paul Newman fucking a beast in this movie, that movie. But I don't think this movie is as good as The Hustler. It's still a really good movie. And it's also really interesting to see like early Tom Cruise. Like Tom Cruise is really riding he's kind of like stomping on Ellen's couch, Tom Cruise. He's really riding that line between cocky confidence and just insane flake behavior, which is great because this is what that film calls for.
Yeah.
It's got really good early work by him. It's got really good late work by Paul Newman, of course.
Yep.
And seeing Martin Scorsese take on something. He didn't necessarily want to do this film. He wasn't passionate about this film. Paul Newman just came to him and like, hey, I want you, you know, I want to make a movie, a sequel to The Hustler. And I really liked your work on Raging Bull. I want you to make this movie. You're 40-year-old Martin Scorsese. You tell Paul Newman to go to fucking pound sand, hit the bricks.
No, of
get out of
not.
Here, pretty boy. No, you fucking do the film. So and this is probably
that impulse, right? Like it makes sense because The Hustler was pretty groundbreaking when it happened.
Certainly,
from like a storytelling perspective, it was not the usual fare of the time. So like coming in here and getting a director like Martin Scorsese to direct this film, who's known for kind of breaking those molds, I think that was probably a smart idea.
Yeah. And like I don't think, unlike like we were talking about this in the previous or in our like just kind of banter before the podcast, but like, you know, like Steven Spielberg has a pretty good sample. If you want like, you know, very artistic auteur films, serious films, he's got that work, but he's also got these like mainstream commercially successful Indiana Jones and the Jurassic Parks and things like that. Martin Scorsese doesn't really do things like this. So this is kind of like the only. And like it's kind of crazy because even Kubrick has, you know, his kind of more accessible things that he did to kind of, whereas Scorsese just kind of came out of the gate making, you know, weird, violent meditations on misogyny and stuff like that. This is kind of like the only one, his only kind of like, you know, mainstream movie. And it's kind of interesting to see like what Scorsese does when he's, you know, just kind of like a jobber director, a director for hire. And it's an interesting piece of his bibliography, I guess, or filmography. It's also interesting. There's a whole long soliloquy about Nineball at the beginning of this film. And the voiceover work is done by Martin Scorsese.
Yes. Yeah. Pretty obviously.
Yeah.
If you ever heard an interview with him.
Yeah. So
I guess it was warranted, right? Not a lot of people knew what Nineball was at the time. I don't really know. 86, I certainly wasn't playing much Nineball. I was four years old. So I don't know what the pool scene was like then. But
well, that's the thing. Is like, I don't think, and we talked about this in The Hustler, like, I don't think this movie requires you to have a vast well of pool knowledge. And just like The Hustler, just like The Queen's Gambit, it excels at making a sport that is probably not very accessible to a person just watching a game, especially at high level. It makes it through the use of montages and the use of like just those like crazy shot after crazy shot, finesse shot after finesse shot. It just kind of like has that kind of, and then there's this one like where you finally build up to one of the pivotal pool matches. Like they use those balls slamming against each other and like violent conflict to simulate the conflict between the two men involved. It reminded me of like John Woo using like white doves or crashing surf to kind of, you know, underline a physical battle. These are using the crashing and conflicting the balls in rapid editing style, you know, smashing together to kind of show like the roiling psychological combat that's happening.
Yeah.
Over like a pool table. Stuff. Yeah. It's really cool. And again, like Newman, man, is so cool and is so solid in this movie. And there's a couple scenes in the middle of the film where he's just sitting on one of those weird, goofy pool high chairs, kind of slouched, where it's recognizably the same guy that plays 48 Hours of Pool and The Hustler. Like, he's got that 1,000-yard stare. He's got that hungry look. You know, the angle, and it's just, it's so cool to see. It's just like a time machine. Like, you could dissolve from the 1959 Hustler into this, and it would look amazing.
Yeah, and Scorsese really uses you know, uses every part of the Newman in this movie.
He does,
because those scenes are evocative. Like, everything when I'm looking at that man's face, I'm seeing scenes from The Hustler, right? I'm thinking about him, you know, being the brash hustler who thinks he can take out Minnesota Fats, and, you know, ends up losing to all the stuff that happens in The Hustler. I'm seeing it, and I'm seeing it through his eyes, replaying in front of him through Tom Cruise. And all of that is just, you know, wordlessly conveyed by staring at Paul Newman.
What do you think of Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio? Because I watched a lot of her stuff growing up, and she's kind of like, you know, a cold cerebral ball buster in Abyss. I didn't really like, I thought her, well, she's very good as Maid Marian and Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. And that's kind of the only stuff I'd seen her in. I think she's also in, what's that, Nor'easter, The Perfect Storm.
Oh,
okay. I was blown away by how good she is in this film, and some of the early scenes, like, until I got a good look at her, I was like, is this Famke Janssen? Like, I was trying to do the math, like, she's like 12 years old. There's no fucking way.
Yeah,
she is so attractive, and so plays like this really cool against Tom Cruise's hot. It's great, because the other thing is, like, this, if you're familiar with The Hustler, like, I was kind of dreading the entire movie, Paul Newman trying to, you know, get a hustle in that area, you know, right, especially with his, and that was like and I felt like that everyone in this movie had really good chemistry. And it's just a matter of, like, you know, how big of a shit is Paul Newman going to be? But I thought she did really, really good work.
She's in Scarface as Tony's sister or Manny's sister, which
real oh yeah 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 it's Manny's
Manny's
right?
sister. I think it's Manny's sister, yeah. I can't remember exactly. But and then she just, after The Abyss, I've not seen anything else she's been in, but she feels like Andy McDowell with a little more of an edge, and I don't know why she didn't have that career, because Andy McDowell's had a heck of a career.
Another good early work by Forrest Whitaker. You know, he comes in as like a cool hustler, and he's just a weirdo. Like,
he's got a lot more energy than you'll see from him in a lot of the recent roles he's taken.
Sure, which is interesting, because, like, the younger Forrest Whitaker had a lot more energy than, you know, obviously old man Forrest Whitaker. But yeah, I've seen him here, and like, he's kind of like a flakier flake than Tom Cruise. And Newman realizes that, Fast Eddie realizes that too late, question mark?
Yeah, I think he's more controlled, right? Like, he is a flake, but he has more control over that flake persona. He's doing the thing that Paul Newman wants Tom Cruise to do in this movie. Be himself without, you know, being able to turn on and off being yourself.
I think I created the false character of Robert Newman. And it's now, I think I did that between The Hustler and what was that, the Tom Hanks movie where he was the bad guy? Between those.
Not The Verdict. Yeah, the Irish mafia movie.
Yeah, I can't. That shit. I'm drawing a blank. Between that, I think I created the composite Robert De Niro and Paul Newman, the Robert Newman. I've infected you with it. It's great. How much more do we want to talk about this before we kind of get down to spoilers? Because maybe I could lay out the plot for people who, because that's the thing. It's like, I've heard of this movie. I had no idea it was a sequel to an older movie. I thought it was about Wall Street. I think I got this
Wall Street and this confused.
I think I did.
It's literally just called Wall Street. Like,
when I was a kid, I think I got, I saw like old dudes on the cover with younger guys, and it's something about greed and money or something. I don't know. Anyway, this movie is about a retired pool hustler who is now selling alcohol to bars. He's selling shitty alcohol that you put in good alcohol and you make profit. And he also does some, what do they call it? Staking? Horse staking?
Stake horsing, I think is the term. Stake horsing.
I got it flipped. Where a person with money will pay a pool hustler, you know, essentially be their money man.
Yeah, it's Bert from the first movie, right?
Exactly. And he's doing one of those things with John Turturro, and he's running scams in bars and stuff. And he notices this kid who is just electric and taking over the room and just like showy, splashy dominance of pool. And it's Tom Cruise and it's Mary Elizabeth, their boyfriend and girlfriend, and she's kind of his manager. And he steps in there, quickly determines that none of them have any idea of what to do and how to really hustle at pool. And as the veteran hustler, he is offering to, again, be the Bert from the first movie, take a big chunk of their winnings to stake them and then navigate them like the move them up from these backroom, low money, low stakes hustles all the way to the big time in Atlantic City. And there's just tons of hustler wisdom and life lessons. And, he's trying to break Tom Cruise like a horse, like a wild horse. Mm-hmm. And it goes in surprising directions. At least I was surprised in the directions it went to. Okay. So if you want to see this movie, I think you should, it's a great one. But now we're going to talk about spoilers.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah, well. Lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content plus ad-free feeds.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
Can we start right there in that first scene?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, because I love the first half of this movie. I think might be slightly better than the second half of this movie, but only slightly. And these early scenes, absolutely love. Just even the way that like he discovers Tom Cruise tells you so much about him. If you haven't seen The Hustler and you know nothing about Fast Eddie Felsen, this scene sets it up so perfectly. Like he's running a hustle, kind of running a hustle on this bar owner, right? Who I guess we find out later he's sleeping with. I don't know. There's a lot of entangled relationships here, but
there's some history here that we don't know about, but we kind of absorb through the movie. Yeah.
But he's running a hustle there, and then he hears this break behind him, this loud, thunderous break, right? And he's like, "Damn!"
Thunderstroke.
He's pulled out of the very. He's very focused, and somebody comes up to him, and he's like, "Look, I'm running a thing here. Get the fuck off me!" But when he hears that break, he's pulled away, right? His own brain pulls him away, and he notices the break and goes, "God damn!" So it tells you like this guy is all about this hustle. Oh, but he hears this thing that is very interesting to him, and so you kind of get a lot from even that first shot. And this scene just evolves in a beautiful way too.
And it's a slow burn because, you know, it's not just a, that's what finally wrenches his attention from his business deal. But like John Turturro coming up, hey, I got this guy in the ropes, got to get another 20. I'm trying to hustle him. Sure. Comes back a minute later, you know, or like 2 minutes later. Hey, I need another 20. He's like, you know, I swear I got this guy. He's about to crack. Like 45 seconds later, comes back. And it's like becomes, and then like, so like his awareness is gradually... You're right. It's mm-hmm. it's kind of like the opening Godfather scene. If like, you know, Fredo was coming in every 45 seconds being like, dad, you know, I need to buy $100 because it's good because it's like, what the hell is going on? Who is hustling the hustler here? And then, you know, Tom Cruise at the height of his young boyish powers is the payoff. And I think he delivers.
Yeah. And there are two hustles going on in this scene too, right? It's not just, you know, him hustling the bar owner trying to sell his booze, but also then he gets into hustling Carmen, who's kind of managing Tom Cruise at that point, and his girlfriend, and he's got two simultaneous hustles going here. And I love this $500 because he's trying to teach her how much she doesn't know. And also he's not buying a game for $500, right? He's buying this kid for $500. It's,
yeah.
I mean, he never gives him the $500 and the game is never taken, but that would have been the offer essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a way to like, and the dialogue, just like in the previous movie, there's so much kind of like, I guess I would call it folk wisdom in this kind of like, you know, There's like a lot of all this kind of hustler street smarts type stuff that he's delivering. And I just, this is a great scene of like this older guy coming in and just intimidating the fuck. He's like, just the way he looks at her is like, hey, because at this point, Tom Cruise is like twirling this fucking stick around like Donatello from the Ninja Turtles, challenging everyone for like, you know, it's like he's taking every $20 out of everyone's pocket and like, come on, you fucking pussies. And he comes up, he's like, I'm your Huckleberry, and slides over 500. And she sees the danger. It's like the big bad wolf coming in and wanting to play. But and he's like, you know, you're giving up $500. And the way he kind of mind fucks her, where she's like, OK, we'll take it. You shouldn't, because, you know, I'm dangerous and I'm unknown. And then she's like, OK, I won't. But also, I can't hardly see anything and I suck at pool. And I haven't played pool in 25 years. OK, it's
it would have been the right choice. But how do you determine that? You know, that's
it's a great sales pitch, right?
It's incredible. Yeah. And then taking them to, you know, the cafe or the restaurant, whatever, afterward. It might even be in the same bar. I can't remember. But he's got all the tricks down. He's got the confusion going, right? I think of like hustlers who try and shortchange people. They at cashiers, right? They come in and they swap around all this money. They get you looking in one direction. You're all confused. You think you have a handle on it, but do you? He does that to her, and then to Vincent, he's just like negging him, right? He's like,
sure,
you're a character, man. And Vincent's like, hell yeah, I'm a character. I got a ton of character. You hear him say that? And he says, no, I said you are a character.
He Mr. Wolfson from Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, for sure.
I guarantee you Tarantino got a little bit of inspiration. There's like, because that speech is so fucking close to Mr. Wolf, and it's done by such a cool, that's almost exactly the same energy. But yeah, and that's like it's so naturally, like, so the play for Mary Elizabeth, I can't remember her character's name,
Carmen.
Was like, you know, I'm the reason that I feel dangerous because I got way too much money and I'm the unknown. And the problem is he should be the unknown. He should not be striding in here like a colossus. He should be, you know, like you got to set like a long term, like, yeah, making $20 from somebody is cool, but what's even cooler is making $5,000 from the fattest shark in the pool hall. And those guys aren't stupid. And if you show how much, you know, so like, I thought that stuff was really cool. And with him, you're right. It's like he's doing this elaborate negging thing, you know, explaining the concept of his the flake. Did they? Because there's so much in common between Tom Cruise's portrayal and in this one and Paul Newman in the original. Did they actually go into flaking in the, is that a term from the first movie, or is this something?
I don't think so. No.
Okay. Interesting. Cause like, I guess the way I understand the flake as described in this movie is a person with a personality and attitude that compels men to challenge them. You know, like Michael Jordan is a great flake. Reggie Miller is a great flake. Like someone who is not just good, because you can respect greatness, but someone who knows he's good and you want to like fucking take him down a peg. And he's like, you know, if you take that natural ability and you pair it with an ounce of brains, then you're going to go somewhere. And unfortunately, this movie, I think is saying that like Newman eventually gives up trying to teach him the lessons that he learned 30 years ago and decides this, fuck it, I'm going to get fitted for glasses and take over the world again.
I think there's a line pretty early on where he's talking about pool as compared to golf. And he says, like, isn't there a Masters tournament or something that you can join, like the old timers? And I think that comes into play later. It's something that kind of roams around in Eddie's head over the course of this. And when the going gets really tough, and he sees that this horse is just not going to be tamed, then he kind of puts that in front of him, right? And says, okay, this is my new goal. Like, I still love this game. I can't get back into it through stakehorsing this lunatic, but can I do it myself?
Yeah, it's weird. It's got the rare, or maybe it's not super rare, but it seems like the rare in movies, like five act structure, where like you go like where you think you're going to have the conventional three acts, and then the third arc, they abruptly end it. And there's a fourth one that begins where, and I put in my notes, like, this is essentially old folks hustling. Yeah. You know, like he's taken his first victim is a woman that looks like she's got a fanny pack and a vice. She would look at home parked in front of a one arm jack for like 18 hours on a Vegas floor. Right.
For
sure. Like, you know, but like he's, you know, obviously starts small and he works himself up into the big game. But like, I feel like I want to jump to a couple of interpretations of this movie, because I think we just talked about the plain reading of the situation, which is Paul Newman tries to teach this kid, you got to have patience. You got to stop chasing the small money. You got to allow yourself to be humiliated and shown up, so that you can ultimately humiliate and rob blind the fat cats.
Yeah.
And this kid will not get that message ever. Like, and there's this one scene where his girlfriend has to threaten withholding of the pussy.
Right.
At the 11th hour, before it's one stroke too late to keep him from, you know, fucking up the, you know, essentially making this town nuclear winter for them. There's no way they can make money. And he just gets fed up and leaves. There's another interpretation, though, that this is all just a hustle within the hustle.
Sure.
Because they show that, like, you know, after he has this kind of disappointing thing with Tom Cruise where, you know, he's sitting up there in his high chair, and instead of like, you know, acting out or walking out or doing all the different psychological tactics he's tried to rein Vincent in, he just is letting it happen. And like Mary Elizabeth finally has to get up and, like, you know, again, play the pussy card. And it brings him in line temporarily. And he's like, you know what? Yeah, you did good. You did the right thing. I'm going to go play pool. Knowing that Tom Cruise is going to have to see, he's never watched this guy play pool before. Yeah. He's going to have to see what the fuss is all about. And Newman gets pantsed by the Last King of Scotland, Forest Whitaker. And I think this is a work. Because Newman is a great actor, and his acting like he is humiliated and shamed and hustled is not great.
I agree.
Like, it looks like a good actor pretending to be a bad actor so that we're kind of in on the joke.
This is tough. This is the question. And at that point, my mind was racing with the next scenes because I was like, okay, I'm looking for the angle. Is he setting him up
here? You were seeing this the second time. You were thinking, like, you were trying to validate this theory too. Okay.
Yeah. Cause my first time through, I definitely had those thoughts. The second time through, I'm looking for the angles. I'm seeing if there is, and I don't think there is. So this movie is peculiar because if it's a five act structure, it only gives you four of those acts. It doesn't give you the payoff, right? So you're left to kind of imagine what's going to happen at the end of this. Though I will say, I think the movie says what's going to happen, but you need to know who Fast Eddie Felsen is, really. And I understand that because I've seen The Hustler. I'm not so sure that you understand the end of this movie the way it's meant to be understood if you haven't seen The Hustler.
How do you think it's supposed to be understood? Because I've seen The Hustler, but I've only seen it one time. And I think he
changes the game at the end of this. If you look at this whole movie as like a metaphor seen through pool, and you can say Fast Eddie Felsen is straight pool. He's cool. He's got patience. He's got endurance. He's got finesse and concentration, focus. And then you look at Tom Cruise and you say all the opposite things about him. He's nine ball. He's the banger. He's the power, right? He's like got all this raw something there, but it is not attuned to the game he's trying to play. And so I think at the end of this movie, Paul Newman switches the game on him. It's no longer nine ball that he's been trying to play. When he says, like, I might not beat you today, but I'll come back and I'll beat you in Houston. I'll beat you in New Orleans. Right. He's playing straight pool. He's playing the long game. And I think you can understand that through this movie, but I really feel it through The Hustler.
Yeah, so because that's going back to my...
Yeah, I didn't really answer the
crazy
question.
Interpretation.
I think the movie is playing straight, but...
So Newman just kind of sucked in that scene.
I think so. Because
here's the thing. Like, I'd have to see it again, and you have seen it, and I'm glad you were looking for this angle, so you're probably right. Because, like, I was kind of geared up to, like, there'd be something, but I think you're right. The movie does play it straight to where... But it just felt like he was at such a crossroads with Vince, and like he was trying. So when he's like, well, I can't break through this guy, and to the extent that I can, his girlfriend can do it better. So like, I'm going to take this opportunity to teach this guy a lesson for good. And I'm going to do it by coming back and humiliating him with all, like, you know, I'm going to be the, you know, it's the tale of the have you heard the tale of the old bull and the young bull, and they're up on the hill, and the young bull's like sees all these cows down in the valley. He's like, let's run down there and fuck one of these cows. And the old bull's like, hey, let's walk down there and fuck them all. I feel like Newman is in that kind of like old bull, like, okay, yeah. you are so blind to I'm actually going to rob you blind with my technique. But like, but then it could be so like it started off on that, but he does kind of get reignited. And the fact that the thing that really fucks up my theory is that Tom Cruise double hustles him.
Right.
Where you're like, and it's brilliant inversion, because I was like, ah, interesting. I was not seeing Newman prevailing over Tom Cruise, but he did. And then Tom Cruise. I guess that's the other question. Did Tom Cruise really hustle him, or was that him covering, you know, the saving face? Like when he comes and says, oh, yeah, you beat me, huh? But you didn't really beat me. I actually threw not just one, not two, not I actually threw four different balls against you and had you thinking that you actually beat me. Here's your cut of the winnings, buddy. Was that legit, or was that him fucking with them?
I think so. I think, you know, the thing that he did succeed in is teaching Carmen. You know, he might not have been able to teach Vincent, Tom Cruise's character, but he definitely taught Carmen how to handle Vincent. And when they come back later in the movie, after he's gone off and done his, you know, old folks home hustling, he is different. Right. And they talk about how, like, they're kind of in sync. And you wouldn't even recognize Vincent. He's a new man. Right. She has taught him all that. I think, yes, that final lesson with Eddie taught him something, but then she continued on that and actually tamed him. So that's where I come down on it. Like, she has taken up that torch and run with it. And he is not hustling Eddie in this scene. He's hustling everybody else, right? He's now playing that longer game.
Gotcha.
But gotcha. And then I guess, like, the ending comes down to me, like, who's the better you know, with my metaphor, straight pool player here, right? Who's got the more endurance, who's got more finesse and patience and is going to ride this thing out. And to me, it's still Eddie, because he's been at this longer, and he isn't quite the flake that Tom is, that Vincent is.
Right, so especially at this age.
Yeah, I do see him like beating Vincent eventually, but I don't think Vincent was trying to hustle him at that point. And I don't, unless he's trying to impart some final lesson to Vincent, I don't think he's hustling him through the last third of this movie.
So I read, because this is what I always love to do. If Rodriguez written a review, like my last thing before I sit down and record is like to see what he thought about it. And I was, rarely have I been as shocked as when I saw the masthead, Roger Ebert, Color of Money, 1986, 2.5 stars. Holy shit, that's like savage. Like, you know, like anything below 3 stars with Ebert is kind of like, it's not worth your time. And he, you know, and like I said, it's like, this is like, and for a Martin Scorsese film, like this is extraordinarily savage. Mm-hmm. And I was reading it and it's like, you know, he's like, talk about how bored. I wonder if the movie hadn't, I feel like the movie would be more interesting if at the end you realize that Newman was doing like an Uber hustle, a hustle within a hustle within a hustle, that he is actually like a couple times you think maybe Tom Cruise has gotten the upper hand on him. And it turns out that he was just, you know, doing it to set up the bigger hustle.
I kept looking for it. I was wondering, okay, did Vincent throw these games so that he'd get him? Because, you know, early on, he talks about the real money isn't in the tournament. The real money is in the practice room. Did Vincent throw the tournament so that he'd, you know, fleece Eddie in the practice room? Well, not exactly. He threw it so that he could fleece everyone else in the practice room, right? It's not necessarily a hustle on Eddie. And I don't think Eddie's hustling Tom or Vincent here. I don't know.
I kept it's funny because the second that Newman stepped back into the pool hall, like at a high level, I kept on expecting George C. Scott in like a wheelchair and like an oxygen mask with a whole bunch of geezers and like walkers and canes with like tire irons. Like, we told you, Eddie, we told you never to step foot in this pool hall again. But there's, I mean, obviously, that kind of scared him straight. Like the experiences from that first movie, and all those guys are dead now. Like, oh, hardly anyone. That's kind of one of the pleasures of the film. One of the real pleasures of the film is actually how much it kind of trades on that hustler. Like when you go to what we called the Mecca, or like the Notre Dame of pool halls, like, you know, just like this hallowed almost church atmosphere. They go back to the original set. Mm-hmm. The original location of pool hall, and it's like some furniture warehouse now, just packed full of like mothballs. And I thought that was really funny. But then when you get to Atlantic City, that like nine ball classic is shot to look just like that, kind of like, it's, you know, it's like stepping out onto Wrigley Field or something. You kind of have the hush, you know, like you can feel. I thought that was really cool.
And I love that initial break. The first break, when all the tables are set up, you've got like, I don't know, 32 tables out there or something.
Simultaneous.
An explosion. That is, it's, I don't know how many decibels it is, but it is immensely loud. And it is really, it gets you in the mood to watch some pool.
Yeah. And the other thing is, if you're familiar with the first Hustlers, I just kept on thinking there was like, what lesson did Paul Newman learn from The Hustler? Did he learn the lesson that, like, you know, George C. Scott is a real asshole? Or did he, like, after 25 years of embitterment, is he looking for, like, revenge? Is he, you know, looking for an excuse to, you know, to teach a young punk some lessons? And, like, every time he was alone with Vince's girlfriend, I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ. And there's one time where, like, I thought it's, like, early in the film where she's, I don't know what she's trying to pull. She's trying to pull something. And he's like, fine, let's just fuck right now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like he's trying to firmly establish that this is a business relationship. And I kind of felt like I relaxed, but there's kind of like that Jaws dud. Every time he got alone with her, I'm like, is he going to try to pull the Bert move, you know? But I don't know, because like there's a couple hints throughout the movie, like, you know, he's only taking 60%, which sounds crazy, but like, didn't Bert take 75-80% from him?
He did, yeah.
There's subtle signs that he's much more like his first mentor than the George C. Scott character. And some of the ways he, like, there's like a lot of funny scenes, like where he sets Tom Cruise up to, you know, he's a stake horse, and Tom Cruise is kind of like doing the Tom Cruise shit. So Paul Newman tells his girlfriend, hey, go pull the car around, point it in the opposite direction, blah, blah, blah. And then he just goes up into the balcony and leaves Tom Cruise there to twist in the wind and fight himself out of like all these pool sharks. Like, yay, pay up your money, you fucker. I thought that was hilarious.
It is. And it evokes, you know, the thumb breaking in the first movie.
Yeah, but that's I think why it works, because it's funny, but there's also that element of like, man, is he gonna like humble this guy with broken thumbs?
Right.
Or what the hell? And the other thing is like, you know, because the Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio, she's always like poking holes in Eddie's facade, but I was also in my notes like, but is it a facade?
I don't think so.
But I didn't think so either. But then we get to that point where he just crumbles in the face of Forrest Whitaker. And I'm like, well, maybe some of his bravado and, you know, cause like, look how fast it fell away. He's like, yeah, like, you know, your excellence is pool. What is that line about? If you have excellence, you can always arrange the money. And she's like, well, what's your excellence? My excellence is, you know, reading humans. And he just like, you know, has this ironclad, but like, you know, when he demonstrates it, it's a fraud. Because he's like, this guy's going to, you know, flame out in 30 seconds. And he's off by like 3 seconds. And then he's like, double or nothing. For tonight's dinner bill, I bet you can walk out that girl in less than 2 minutes. Well, turns out she's an old acquaintance.
Yeah.
So he's able to say, hey, I know this is kind of weird, but I need you to come out and look at something in my car. And she's like, bemused. But like, I was like, maybe the movie's suggesting that a lot more of this is a front, that he's a lot more emotionally like fucked up and damaged from the first movie, even 25 years later. I mean, this guy's has been scared off a professional pool by that experience for 25 years. So getting back. Yeah. Like I wondered how much of his stuff was bullshit.
Yeah, that's a good question, because there is definitely part of this movie where it works flawlessly. Right. And that is recruiting Vincent into this lifestyle in the first place. And those scenes are wonderful. I absolutely love everything that happens at the toy store, and then everything that happens at the pool hall after that. Just the way he's playing them, right? He's got
all the angles.
Vincent
for both of them.
Trusting his judgment about Carmen more than Vincent's own judgment, right?
Do you think he's right?
Just by planting a seed? No, I don't think he's right. I
so
never
you didn't
saw
think she was getting bored.
I never saw anything about that from her. Not really. But who knows?
It makes sense, though. It makes sense, this guy fucking around for, you know, he's working at Toys R Us and he's, you know, hustling people for $20 at the pool hall. And she's just, like, that did seem like it had. Yeah, I don't know. Like, is that something someone does for 10 years, or is that something someone does? But that's the other thing, is like, I never really had an idea of like how their relationship was, how long they'd been dating, all that kind of stuff. So I had to take Newman at his human supercomputer for, you know, study of the student of humanity. You know, you study to watch, I study you, kid. Mm-hmm. I had to take him at his word. So I guess I thought that he had seen something of a frustration with her, or a boredom of like the sameness of this. And
maybe also, I would think if that were true, he wouldn't need to fake it, right? Because he sends her out for cigarettes, and at the exact time where he knows Vincent is going to be out in the pool hall looking for her. And when he doesn't find her, he's going to worry that she's left him.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
And just
he
gotten
definitely
bored with the whole thing, right? So he's manipulating things behind the scenes, which to
he's
me
so,
says
like,
he's making it happen. It's not there already.
Yeah, he reminds me so much of Ben Kingsley's character in Searching for Bobby Fischer.
Yeah.
With like the Balabushka. The Balabushka is, you know, Josh, I forget his last Baskin name. That's his chess master certificate, right?
For sure. Yeah.
Can I get the Balabushka? No, not yet. It's not ready. You're not ready for it. But he's like, he's like this curious amount of like building him up and then knocking him down to try to break him, because Tom Cruise is a maniac. Tom Cruise, like, you don't even have to try that hard you can be like some jobber to just be like, huh, don't choke on a $100 bet. And that's enough for him to make the pool hall radioactive. That's enough for him to go in the killer shark when he knows there's a whale with $5,000 in his pocket.
And there's other stuff that Eddie's doing during this movie that I think is so good. The other hustle that he's like half running this whole time is the booze hustle. He's trying to sell this old McDonald, which is hilarious, to this bartender. He takes her out on a date to a bar where he's already sold the old McDonald and orders old McDonald from that bar just to let her see that other bartenders are serving this stuff.
Sure.
It's just like, you know, it's when it's revealed, it's not subtle, but it's, yeah, I don't know. It's good. I really loved it.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcasts, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
I also love just the pool hall etiquette, man. Like, this is like where betting is a fact of life, but it's also still kind of illegal. And also it's something you could probably get your thumbs broken. So like, you know, in every serious pool hall, there's probably a couple sharks, like local sharks. There's probably, you know, every once in a while, you know, maybe on weekends or, you know, certain nights, there's probably like regional ones. And they all like, it's like a poker game where you don't settle who's best over a hand of poker. You kind of like are trying to rank. Like, are you the mark or are you the shark? And if you're the mark, you don't play, right? Like, and I, like, how you feel that out and how people get reputations and how you can, like, I mean, it's brilliant. You got this unknown quantity. He's essentially like, you got a sandbag, kid. You need to go into Atlantic City. Yeah. So it's almost like you're making money two ways. You're making money on your winnings, but also you're essentially betting on yourself and getting huge long odds, you know? And I just thought that stuff was just like in the first film. It's just fascinating. Like this underworld, you know, and I've always, every time I go into a pool hall, I always wonder, I look around because, you know, you can tell there's some people there like all the fucking time.
Yeah.
And they've got like pool cue cases and stuff like, you know, who is the shark here? how much money would I lose if I talked to the wrong guy in this hall?
Right.
I thought that stuff is cool. And they do a lot of it in this film.
Yeah. I don't know what it is about these kind of movies, but it's the seedy nature of it. It's the danger. It's the real skill, the blend of all of them. But I feel the same way about this movie as I feel about the movie Rounders with Matt, or
I've not seen that one.
Matt Damon, where he's a poker player and it's essentially very similar to this movie. He's the Tom Cruise, I guess. And he's trying to beat this guy played by John Malkovich. And the guy's just a student of humans and he can't beat him because he always knows his number. And poker lends itself to that naturally, right? I mean, that is the game. In pool, the hustle is the real game you're playing. The pool is the game you play to get to the hustle, I guess.
Yeah, God, there's so many great quotes. Like, the money won is twice as sweet as money earned. I don't know why that is, but it is fucking 100% true.
Oh yeah.
Like, it's not that hard to earn $700, you know, in a given, week or, you know, whatever. But like every time, like I've gone to Vegas and like won $700 on Sunday's worth of games, it's like, you feel like you're like rich.
Yeah.
You know, it felt like you got $7,000 instead. And the two things you need to win, brain and balls, and you got too much of one and not enough of the other. I thought that was, that's another great, great line. And also like shades of George C. Scott when he essentially walks out on him, rage quits the whole partnership, and Tom Cruise goes on and he just, you know, he radiates the pool hall and he won a lot of money, but like a tenth of what he actually won.
Yeah.
And after he dresses him down and browbeats him and insults him and has him begging for more, he then makes him give his 60% cut. Mm-hmm. And so like, and fucking Tom Cruise does it. No complaints. And it's like, oh God, it's great. And just like the montage of like him learning, like, you know, shows him kind of like sandbagging a little bit, but also shows him pushing too far and him getting in a fight and he has to kick some dude in the balls with like a Bruce Lee. Watch out. The montages are really good. The montage is really entertaining.
Yeah. The other scene I really like, and there are a few of them, but one that stands out because of how good of an actor Paul Newman is the one where they're doing Two Brothers and a Stranger. That scene, there's a moment where like the plan works, right? Because Paul Newman's up there and he's, you know, been stirring up shit and everybody wants to see these two go at each other on the table. But nobody can put up the cash because it's so much cash. It's $500 for a single game. And then the bartender, he gets in on it. He's like, well, I got $1,000 from, you know, selling these fools booze. Let's just gamble with their money, essentially.
Right,
so he ups it to $1,000, and the look that Paul Newman, it's why he's such an amazing actor, because he gives the audience absolutely everything they need in this shot where he, like, the bartender says $1,000 and his face turns, but it doesn't turn enough. This, I've talked about this before, where if you're trying to convey something to the audience that you don't want the actors in the room to have discovered, that is a fine fucking line to walk. He walks it so perfectly here. There's a tinge of a smile on his face, but only if you know what's up. And then he looks, the camera follows his eyes around to the bartender. It's just a perfect shot.
Yeah. And it's also works because like Tom Cruise is playing the part, but you can tell he's getting genuinely pissed.
Yes.
At not the stuff that he's saying, but like at him, you know, putting his hands on his girlfriend to sell the act.
And Newman and it's also, is riding that line with him, right? Like he knows he could push this guy way too far and he would just come at him with a stick or whatever.
Right. And he almost did. He almost did.
Yeah.
And that's like, you know, like it's guys, but it's maddening watching characters. The older I get, the harder it is to watch a character like Tom Cruise here. We're like, you know, Paul Newman's got one sermon, you know, like we are building towards something. Mm-hmm. There is a pot of gold at the end of this rainbow. Yes, you're going to have to swallow your pride. Yes, you're going to have to go some sort of humiliation, but you got to like count the Monte Cristo. This, you got to keep your eyes on the prize when you eventually get your comeuppance. It's going to be that much sweeter. And like Cruise just can't get it. Like he keeps asking, he's like, hey, can we ever do a hustle where I win? Like, no, motherfucker. Because we don't want you. We want you rolling into Atlantic City as an overconfident, blowhard, easily rattled guy. So, you know, like the whole thing is like you're a flake, but you can't switch it on and off. You got to be able to switch off the flake. So when it's time to make money, you make all this go away. And he just doesn't really get it until I guess the end of the film.
Yeah, he just doesn't have any patience. And the balabushka, the stick that he gives him, the fancy stick, mm-hmm. is kind of the stand-in for that, right? For their goal. You can't have the balabushka. You can't use it right now. But this, take a look at it. This is what is waiting for you if we execute this. Because you're only going to hustle for a certain amount of time, and then rep's going to get out. Word's going to get out about you. And then you're playing the tournament scene, right? And you can use the balabushka. You can have people who are young kids thinking, oh, I can take on this guy. You know, I'm better than him. And you can whip the floor with them. Wipe the floor with them. But you got to wait.
There's only one time as a pool hustler you can really do that.
Exactly.
Like once you're a known quantity, you will essentially have to work your ass off to make a tenth of the money.
Right.
Because everybody, I guess at that point you just become the whale of a pool hall and you're like Domino, Fats Domino from the first. You're just waiting for would be hustlers to come fuck you over. But
right.
Yeah, that's the frustration. It's like, dude, kid, you literally only have one shot at this. You've got mm-hmm. one shot of being the unknown quantity. Once you win, like, I don't know what the hell you got to do. Break your thumbs and people are like, I don't know. He's got his thumbs broke.
Right. Take 25 years off and.
You do like the kingpin thing where you get your arm mangled in a bowling ball machine and then people, it's like there's not many times where you can like, you know, change people's opinion or have them underestimate. Or like you said, due to Paul Newman, where you get scared off and you spend 25 years not playing.
Right.
But I also think one of the charms of the first movie was how good, relatively speaking, Paul Newman. Uh-huh. And Jackie Gleason were like Jackie Gleason is a legitimately good and they're making the shots and the camera's not cheating. I found it very distracting how like Paul Newman's first break, which is one of those like thunderstroke breaks, clearly is jump edited because I don't think Newman can do it, or essentially he can't break it and make it the exact configuration that he needs to then go around and hit easy shots as he's lecturing Tom Cruise on how to play pool. Like there's a jump shot. Tom Cruise can't jump pool balls. And there's another weird slow-mo jump cut to kind of so you go from Tom Cruise to the actual pool expert. And that kind of bothered me because it was kind of incredible how good the pool was from the main actors in the first movie. And this one, like they had a couple of pros. Mm-hmm. Doing and there's some just amazing shots, but you hardly ever see like Tom, like a couple times, but you hardly ever see like Tom Cruise or Newman themselves lining them up and shooting one. There's almost always a way to cheat it because they're just, even though I guess Tom Cruise got to be really good, he got a pool table
and he studied good.
And Scorsese was even like, this guy probably in another couple weeks could do this shot, but like Scorsese also said famously, this is the only movie he ever delivered on time and under budget. So he was like really trying to do like I'm trying to make a mainstream film here. I'm trying to hit my marks and all that. So but I kind of wish you'd given Tom Cruise the extra couple weeks because that'd have been sweet.
Yeah, we do know he loves to do his own stunts. So I don't know if you consider shooting pool balls, maybe jumping a pool ball a stunt.
Clearly he wanted to. And like I said, there's some good, decent shots. Like Paul Newman has a really good cross the table kind of arcing that he actually shot. Mm-hmm. And I think Tom Cruise has one or two, but like just not anywhere near from my recollection, the first movie, where it's like even to a layman, like, fuck, those are some sweet, tricky shots.
Yeah, for sure. Tom Cruise is weird. Is that a controversial thing to say?
He is weird. He's a very weird guy.
His energy in this. So when I think of Tom Cruise, I think of off the charts charisma. I'm not exactly certain that that's what he's bringing to this. He's bringing charisma, but he's also bringing that manic couch jumping energy that like is too much.
It's too much. Like I said, the whole Donatello routine, like I don't know how he didn't get jumped. Like,
the Werewolves of London, that whole scene, it's a little off-putting. And I don't know if that kind of defines the kind of
It's like his underwear dancing and Risky Business, except for he's doing it in front of an audience of hundreds.
Right.
You know? Like, that's one thing to be that crazy in your own home, but it's stomping on Oprah's couch when he got engaged to what's her face. Like, it's just like, okay, you're at an 11 and I need you down at about an 8, you know,
for sure. I do wonder if that has somehow defined his career, because when I look at Tom Cruise's career versus a lot of other stars of that time, young, attractive men from that time, I think of like the Brat Pack kind of people. I think about everybody who's mixing and mingling with other, you know, attractive, young, popular actors at the time. Tom Cruise didn't do a ton of that. Like,
no,
I look at Top
didn't.
Gun and I see Val Kilmer. Okay, that's one where he did do that stuff.
Still not really Brat Packy though.
No, for sure. He didn't have that phase of a career, and it felt like every movie that he did was defined by Tom Cruise, as opposed to like, hey, look at all these hot young popular stars we configured into a group, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just so strange. It's so strange. And it persists to this day where and it might be partially his reputation. I don't know if he's hard to work with, but he's certainly got a rep now as a Scientologist. But then I expected him to work more with people of his age, like who were popular in that era, but he just doesn't do it. And yet he became like the biggest movie star on the planet. He is the draw for his movies. Not in the way that like, Robert Downey Jr., Rob Lowe, those guys always kind of mixed it up with others.
But also he didn't play that like angsty stuff either. Like every one of his early roles is like Tom Cruise, megawatt smile, hyper masculine. He's a fucking NASCAR driver. He's a fucking Top Gun. He's a, I don't know, cocktail twirler. Okay. you know, but he's like always like playing this like amped. He doesn't do any kind of like introspection or, you know, like anytime he's down bad or like he gets goose killed. It's just the springboard he needed to get, you know, to find his will to win or whatever. I don't know. And it's like, I think the whole deal is like a lot of his career has been managed by Scientology. So like, maybe that was their stress. Like, don't ever do that. Now I know he has like, you know, like what Vanilla Sky is Tom Cruise being pretty fucking angsty. Magnolia is Tom Cruise being pretty fucking angsty. But he didn't get to that shit until he was in his like 40s, man.
Yeah, those are 2000s movies. Like he had a run from the 80s through the 90s that was remarkably Tom Cruise driven. And I don't understand necessarily how, other than I guess he was a phenomenon in the time. Like
he's one of
those
stars.
Everyone loved him.
Yep. He's good looking guy. You know, it's the fucking men, you know, women wanted to be with him and men wanted to be him kind of Austin Powers gag.
Yeah, he's like a generation after me. So I don't really I wasn't watching his movies as they were being made.
I wasn't allowed to watch his movies as they're being made. I came to all that stuff like way after the fact. What else do we have to say about the Color of Money? Oh, the title of this. Like, I kept on expecting someone to say something like the stripe on the 7 is like the color of money, or I don't know. I don't know my colors and balls and all that stuff. But Because they talk about the smell of money.
Sure.
And they talk about this, but like they never get to the color of money. And I was wondering like what that actually was going to refer to.
Color of money is JTS Brown. That's the whiskey he drinks. I don't know, man.
Because like I was like, were they going to talk about the faded felt at these things? Is the like I kept on expecting something to come like the chalk dust is the like a color of old money, or, but they never quite got the title of the movie into the movie itself.
I mean, is color like a stand in here for like the look of money? Because like I don't know.
And there's something Newman's in the Scorsese's ramble up front about colors, like the with the tying the balls. And that's where I thought they would make that kind of illusion. It's, you know, whatever. But
the chalk, is it blue? Is it the chalk? Because he gets a very fancy chalk.
I've seen green chalk. I've seen the white. I've seen the blue chalk. I don't know. I don't know.
This movie was pretty well received. It actually got Paul Newman an Oscar.
His first Oscar, right?
Was it his first? That's insane.
I think so. Like, I guess they awarded him an honorary one for some kind of lifetime achievement the year before, and then he won out one outright. But it is wild.
Yeah.
That this is his.
So best actor in a leading role. He won it. Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio, I think is her name. Maybe that's why she didn't have a huge career. Her last name is very hard to say. Did not win, but she got nominated.
I'm sorry. I just looked at Paul Newman, 10-time Oscar nominee.
Oh.
Finally won an Academy Award for The Color of Money. I think that's his only one to
finally won an Academy Award in the movie Scorsese was slumming in. Great.
Yeah, it'd be like Al Pacino getting an Oscar for A Godfather 3.
Sure. Or Simone or something. Like what the
I
mean this is not Simone. It is much better than some of this stuff,
didn't Scorsese finally get an Oscar for Aviator?
Oh, was he having trouble getting an Oscar too? That's insane.
Oh yeah. That's the thing, it's like, and I like The Aviator, but it's not
Irishman
anywhere near his best. It's not in the top five of his best movies.
No, it's good, but yeah, come on. Best adapted screenplay and best art direction was also nominated for, and none of those won. Apparently A Room with a View is very popular that year.
No, I got that wrong. Scorsese finally got it for The Departed.
Okay.
Which again, not one of his top five movies.
Right.
How much money did you say this thing made?
It made about $52 million on a budget of 14.5. So it was successful, both critically and financially. There's one other thing that this movie spawned, which is wild. I would have never guessed in a million years. John Carmack apparently,
oh shit, I saw this,
decided to name the video game Doom after this movie, after seeing the scene where Tom Cruise goes to the pool hall with the Balabushka, looks down at the box and says, "What's in the box?" Opens it up and looks up at the camera and says, "Doom."
He makes a meal of it.
Oh, dude. Yeah, I mean, he's flashing his smile, and yeah, it's I have a hard time believing that, but I mean, John Carmack said it in an interview. I looked at the source and it was on doomworld.com.
Was it because I thought it was Romero, like is it John Carmack because that feels like a Romero move to me, like you
Carmack
know,
was
kind
one
of
being
ballsy
interviewed.
Fucking crazy. Okay,
but I don't know who thought
yeah
that.
That's I had no idea what an intersection of my childhood interests, you know, like
yeah, it's wild.
It's hilarious though. Id Software is Doom
because
of this pool movie. I guess yeah, like that wasn't that the like in 89 to 90, like that's the Castle Wolfenstein Doom era. So yeah, this would only be years after this movie was made. So it all lines up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's it. The Color of Money. I think it's a worthy sequel to Hustler. A great counter. Like I said, it doesn't besmirch the memory of the Hustler. It's just not quite that good. It's not quite. The movie doesn't go as hard as The Hustler does, because the thing is like,
hard.
I don't think I was expecting Newman to go there, you know, to give it that kind of pathos. But like, you know, nobody dies. Nobody is like bullied into committing suicide. No one gets like there's not nearly as much stakes. Like Tom Cruise doesn't get his legs broke or anything.
Nope.
So it just doesn't have the stakes, but it is fun. And I think you, since it's modern, it's color, it's got Tom Cruise in it. It is, like you said, is a lot more accessible.
Did you wish, let me ask you this. The last thing I want to talk about here, did you see many challenges presented to the character of Eddie, and did you see his character change much in this movie? Because that's one of the things that happens in The Hustler. He very much changes, and he's changed by the events of that movie. This didn't
I think so, because this like is that. Like the inverse and opposite of The Hustler.
I think you're
right. The Hustler is the wild horse that gets broken and then ultimately too much, like broken till he can't even pull a plow or drive a cart or whatever. This is that guy slowly reawakening. And that's why I that's the most puzzling thing in Ebert's review is like, I felt like he deducted a full star because it ended just when he thought the movie got good. And to me, it's like complaining that you don't get to see the fight between Rocky and Apollo at the end of Rocky III.
Okay.
Like, that's not, if you thought that this was building up to like a smoke filled 48 hour marathon pool session between Newman and Cruise, I don't know what the hell movie you were watching, but clearly that's what Ebert was expecting. And he thought he got robbed by not, but like to me, like, yeah, that it was an arc. It's just the exact opposite and inverse arc of The Hustler.
Yeah, it felt like a reawakening to me, where a guy who loves the game of pool had been barred from the game of pool due to circumstance, and he found pool again through this kid, right?
Yeah, and I shouldn't say it's opposite, because like he ends up and almost like it's like the pendulum finally swung to the middle. Because in the first movie, like, he was a mess. He couldn't keep a girl. He couldn't. His priorities are all mess. Like, I feel like he is the master of his domain at the end of this movie. He is, you know, older, wiser, got his eyes fixed so he can play pool. He can still, you know, earn the love and respect of a woman and have a bunch of adventures and stuff. But like, not, you know, he's also seems like he's won most of his battles against alcohol.
Yeah.
Or at least he doesn't go to that like insane self-destructive spiral that he got into the first movie. So like, it's more of a complete arc. It's not like a reversal. It's like a full mastery of his place in the world.
Yeah, I agree.
Anyway, we hope you've enjoyed this week's prestige film. We'll be back next week with another one. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Later.